Actually, I put a little spin on the Tanakh translation. They just say hallelujah and don't translate it. And they don't translate the term they use as Adonai. They just put capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, as in many of your translations. Good afternoon to everybody. If you are listening live, I give you a lot of credit because we have had a delay of an hour. We started out in one building. We had to go to another. A lot of excitement here. But now we're back at the same old stand doing business, but it wasn't going to be that way. We had a beautiful new place to go. Unfortunately, we had some difficulties there, so we had to move back to the original place where we normally are. I'm glad that some of you are watching us live. We informed you we'd be an hour late, and so it's 1 o'clock in p.m. on the West Coast, I guess 3 o'clock in the Central Area, 4 o'clock here on the East Coast. So we're just very grateful you're out there. I know a lot of you will be seeing this later on as we're recording it, and you'll be seeing it probably in all kinds of situations because people are on the move. Even now, you're pausing for this Day of Atonement, but you're already in transit towards your Festival of Tabernacles location. And that's one thing I wanted to talk about today, which is one of my pet peeves in a way. I call this talk A New Beginning for Humanity. A New Beginning for Humanity. This day is so important. I was going to call this talk A Critically Important Day, and then I decided, well, some people might think, well, aren't all the holy days important? Well, yes, but this day is so important, not that the others are not, but one of the problems with this day is it tends to get perhaps a little less respect than it might. I guess people don't like going without food for so long. You know, that's not a popular thing, I guess. But also, it comes between the Festival of Trumpets and the Festival of Tabernacles, and some people are already on the move, on the road. And so this becomes a kind of a stop, you know, on one's trip. And in a way, it takes away from the importance of this particular day because you're already in transit towards some other place and your mind's on that. And that's understandable. In fact, in ancient times, it was very likely the case too, that pilgrims were marching towards the Festival of Tabernacles and perhaps paused also to keep the Day of Atonement wherever they were. But the Day of Atonement is very, very important in its own right, as one of, you know, those six holy times annually together with the seventh-day Sabbath, you know. No, I should put it another way. There are actually 7 days on which we rest in during the year, 7 annual Sabbaths. We have the first day of unleavened bread, the seventh day of unleavened bread, Pentecost, Trumpets, Atonement, and the first day of the Festival of Tabernacles and the eighth day of Sacred Assembly, so there are 7. And this is one of those 7 annual Sabbaths, we can call them. And this is the 5th of them. And you know I've said it before, and I'll say it again. In the Bible, the number 5 has the significance of emphasizing God's love, God's mercy, God's compassion. We can think of a 5-letter word in English, grace, G-R-A-C-E. And this is the 5th day of, 5th of the annual Sabbaths. And it is a time of which pictures and foreshadows the emancipation of the human race. Jesus Christ is truly the great emancipator. I give credit to Lincoln for what he did in America, Abraham Lincoln, the so-called great emancipator. But the greatest liberator is Jesus the Christ. He will liberate humankind. And this day, in a sense, pictures that time of liberation. And it is a time, a new beginning for the human race in a very powerful way. I want to talk about the significance of the Day of Atonement. This is a Bible study format, in case you're wondering. I'm at a table with Bibles, and we don't have music today. We will have music when we get to Washington, D.C. for the rest of the festival. We'll have music then. And we'll have music on the first night of that festival, too, Sunday night. We'll be going to a sermon format, but today is a Bible study format. So we'll see how long it takes. I'll try not to go very, very long, but I'll go as long as I need to go to cover the scriptures I wanted to cover. So let's begin by going to Acts 27. Now, those of you who follow me on Facebook know that I quoted that verse on my last Facebook entry. And you too can follow that if you want. CCK153 has a Facebook page. Acts 27 and verse 9.
But it is the Church of Christian Commandment Keepers.
Right, the Church of Christian Commandment Keepers. It's not me personally. No, it's the CCK153. It's the Church of Christian Commandment Keepers. And in case you're wondering, if you came across us, quote unquote, coincidentally, that's who we are, the Church of Christian Commandment Keepers. That's how the church is described in the book of Revelation, in Revelation 12:17 and Revelation 14:12, I believe it is. We are described as the, in effect, Christian Commandment Keepers. And so that's what we are. Yes, Revelation 14:12. I'm going to get to Revelation, but later. As you know, I often finish my talks going to the end of the Bible, Revelation. But right now I'm in Acts, and I'm in Acts 27:9. Now, when much time had been spent and sailing was now dangerous. Why was sailing dangerous? Because of the season of the year. Storms begin to occur. Because the feast was already over. I'm sorry, the fast was already over. There's a big difference. Well, no, there isn't really, depending on how you translate feast. That's one problem, too, that people have. This is a festival of God. It's an annual festival. And there are festivals during the year, six of them, and the Sabbath comes once a week. But the annual festivals, they are festivals. Because people call them feasts, they mistake the word feast and festival, and they think that it's a time to eat. But we don't eat today. We're fed spiritually, yes. So yes, feasting is a part of the festival. We ought to feast on these days, except this one. But they're more than that, of course. They're more than just time to get together for a banquet. They're more than that, way more than that. But they're called feasts in our language. And, you know, I'm not complaining. I'm just saying that this is a festival, but it is a fast. Now, when much time had been spent and sailing was now dangerous because the fast was already over, Paul advised them. The fast. Well, everybody knows about the fast. In terms of public knowledge, a lot of non-Jewish people who don't keep what they would call the Jewish holidays are aware of the fast. They're aware of the Day of Atonement. And people who know the Bible in a cursory way may have some understanding of the fact that God commanded the Israelites to have a fast once a year. So many people are aware of the fast. And so the New Testament refers to the fast. And we're keeping the fast. You know, Luke refers to it here. Now, what about the fast? Why would we be commanded to fast once a year? Well, I want to tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. If you really are serious about the Bible, about your commitment to a biblical way of life, or as we might put it in 2015 in America, a biblical lifestyle, if you're committed to that, you're not going to just fast once a year. You'll fast more than that. And what does fasting do for us? Well, you know, when you fast, you're in a certain more humble frame of mind. In a way, you die a little. And then when you eat, in effect, you're coming back to life. You're reviving yourself when you drink and you eat after the fast. But in a sense, it's a new beginning. So the fast prepares you for a new beginning. In effect, it's like a death and a resurrection. When you fast and when you, get up from the fast, it's like a resurrection. And so, in effect, you're a new person. Just like in baptism, if you went through the baptism experience, you were drowned, metaphorically, then you were resurrected. There's a Bulgarian joke. And Bulgarians, by the way, they're to be credited. They saved their Jewish population during the Holocaust. That's an incredible story. The Jews of Bulgaria were saved, not exterminated. But there's a Bulgarian joke, supposedly. It says, when you baptize a Jew, hold him under longer. It's kind of a joke. vicious, but anyway, there. I said it because I'm praising the Bulgarians, even though the joke is kind of nasty, because they saved their population, the Jewish population. But anyway, the point I'm bringing out is that the baptism is a kind of drowning. So in my levity here, but the baptism is a kind of drowning. But then you get up. So it's also a kind of birth. You know, you're in liquid when you're in the womb. So the baptism is the baptismal tank or font or body of water is both a womb and a tomb. It's also a womb, and you come out like a baby comes out of the womb, comes out of the liquidy environment, and you come out and you're a new person. You're born again. Is everybody with me so far? So fasting in a way is like that too. When you fast and then you eat and drink at the end of the fast, it's like a rebirth. And that's the point. One of the reasons for fasting is to realize that we need to be in a humble frame of mind. When you're fasting, you don't have the same situation as you normally have in terms of your energy and your strength and your overall exuberance. You tend to be a bit more subdued, perhaps a little bit more solemn, and perhaps in a more teachable frame of mind, you know, and realizing your limitations. And so, in effect, it puts you in a more humble attitude. And therefore, in effect, God can work with you more effectively if from time to time you fast. And you fast also because it is a type of mourning. When we feel bad, we don't eat. Why is fasting a type of mourning? Well, because this is a world of woe and sin and a lot of trouble. We love the world. We love the, you know, the beauty that God has given us and the wonderful experiences we can have in this life, but we also sympathize with those in pain. We realize that life has its problems, and we mourn for the fact that this is not the millennium. Jesus Christ is not here. We mourn because he's not with us. We want him to be with us in the complete sense. And so let's go to Matthew 9. You can find a parallel account, I believe, in Mark, but let's go to Matthew 9, and I want to go to verse 14. Matthew 9 and verse 14. Then the disciples of John came to him, saying, "Why do we and the Pharisees fast often, but your disciples do not fast?" And Jesus said to them, "Can the friends of the bridegroom mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them? But the days will come when the bridegroom will be taken away from them, and then they will fast." So one reason to fast is because we wish, we hope, we pray, you know, for the time when the world will have Jesus Christ's presence here, King of Kings, Lord of Lords, when human beings will truly be free. Now, you know what he does when he finishes this talk about fasting when he's not here? He talks about renewing yourself, being born again, the importance of being a new person so that you can receive what God has for you. His instruction, his example. Look, read on with me. "No one puts a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment, for the patch pulls away from the garment and the tear is made worse." So if you're going to have a new material, you have to have a new garment to put the new material on. "Nor do they put new wine into old wineskins," verse 17, "or else the wineskins break. The wine is spilled, and the wineskins are ruined, but they put new wine into new wineskins, and both are preserved." So, ladies and gentlemen, we need to be each day, in a sense, renewed, constantly being willing to grow and to change as God directs us. And fasting helps put us in that frame of mind. And once a year, the whole community comes together and fasts to be in a proper frame of mind for that great 8 days when we feast together before God. We had the Festival of Trumpets. We heard the shofar, the wake-up call. Shofar, so good, right? Now we're here. You didn't like that pun? All right. Now we're here on the Day of Atonement. And before we have our 8 days of feasting, we have our fast to prepare us to get the most out of the feast, to be in a proper frame of mind, to be teachable, and to really appreciate the blessings that we have when we go to the Festival of Tabernacles in the 8th day, and to sympathize with those who are in need in various ways, to get closer to our Creator, to get closer to one another. It's interesting. A shared experience, in effect, brings a certain closeness, and everybody sharing a fast you know, I think that is a way of pulling the church together in a certain special way. All of us experiencing a fast together. It is something that I think helps bind the church together. Back in Leviticus 23, God's people were commanded to do this. Leviticus 23, and I want to go to verse 28 or so. Let's go to verse 26. And the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, "Also the 10th day of this 7th month shall be the Day of Atonement, Yom HaKippurim." It's Yom HaKippurim in Hebrew, and we shorten it rabbinically to Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement, Yom HaKippurim. "It shall be a holy convocation for you. You shall afflict your souls and offer an offering made by fire to the Eternal." The offering can no longer be made at this time. It just can't be done. I mean, the Temple Mount is right now. You hear all the time news about the Temple Mount, but you can't even pray there, let alone have sacrifices going on. But you can't even pray on the Temple Mount at the moment. But even if a Jew could pray on the Temple Mount, a Christian wouldn't have to, because Jesus Christ is our sacrifice. Anyway, verse 28, "And you shall do no work on the same day, for it is a Day of Atonement, to make atonement for you before the Eternal your God." In other words, to pay ransom, you know, to do what has to be done to free you from guilt. You know, what we call expiation. The English word has an interesting play there. The English word atonement is at-one-ment. And if you speak Spanish, hermanos, brothers, brethren, brothers and sisters, if you speak Spanish, you can say a fast in Spanish is ayuno, A-Y-U-N-O in English. A-Y-U-N-O, right? Ayuno. But you can also say I-Uno, H-A-Y in English, U-N-O in English. I-Uno, there is one. So the word fast in Spanish, ayuno, sounds like I-Uno, there is one. So you can make a good play on words. But that's what they are, plays on words. And they help. But the original Hebrew has to do with, in effect, paying ransom, getting out of a situation of captivity. And in effect, expiation, your guilt is gotten rid of. Now, what's going on here? I'll say more in a moment. Let me just read a couple of more verses. "For any person who is not afflicted in soul on that same day shall be cut off from his people." The whole community comes together in affliction. "And any person who does any work on that same day, that person I will destroy from among his people." Very strong language here. "You shall do no manner of work. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations and all your dwellings. It shall be to you a Sabbath of solemn rest." As I said, you could call it an annual Sabbath. A Sabbath of solemn rest, Shabbat Shabbaton. "And you shall afflict your souls on the 9th day of the month at evening. From evening to evening you shall celebrate your Sabbath." So we go from dark Tuesday night to dark, you know, Wednesday night this year. So here we have this Day of Atonement. Begins on the evening, as we understand. Goes to the next evening. A day of affliction. But it's an affliction which is part of an expiation activity. Justifying us before God as a community each year. Just as the Passover does, in a more powerful sense, perhaps. You know, we take up the Passover in the spring. It's a similar situation there. I want to go to Numbers 29 and verse 7. Numbers 29 and verse 7. "Then the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, What did he say? You'll hear in a moment. I was on the wrong page. All right. Numbers 29, 7. "On the 10th day of this 7th month, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall afflict your souls. You shall not do any work." I wanted to mention that we're going to talk about the high priest later. The high priest, think of him in a way as a marriage counselor or intermediary between a couple that's had a rough year. Their marriage could be on the rocks, but no. We're going to get them reconciled. We're going to get the couple back together. And who does it? The high priest. He's the intercessor, the intermediary, the interlocutor, is that you could call him, talking to the husband and the wife. He's the, in a way, the marriage counselor that gets them back together again. And he does that by the rituals he performs on the Day of Atonement. He reconciles the bride, the wife, which is Israel, or the church, to God, or the Church to Jesus Christ, you can say. We are reconciled to Jesus Christ as we fast and come together in a certain sense. But in ancient Israel, it was a very critically important ceremony. Once a year, the Day of Atonement ceremonies cleared the deck, spiritually speaking, in the Old Covenant way, so that the relationship of wife and husband, Israel and God, could continue. Is everybody all right with that? And I'll say more about that a little bit later. But first I want to talk about afflicting your souls. I want to go to Psalm 35:13. And first let me read it in the New King James. And then I want to go to the Tanakh. Psalm 35 and verse 13. But as for me, when they were sick, my clothing was sackcloth. I humbled myself with fasting, and my prayer would return to my own heart. Now, I humbled myself with fasting. That word can also be translated afflicted, and I think in the Old King James, that's what it says. I afflicted my soul with fasting. And to show you how closely associated afflicting your soul is with fasting, I want to go to Psalm 35 and verse 13 in the Jewish translation, the Tanakh. Psalm 35, verse 13, and it says, yet when they were ill, my dress was sackcloth. I kept a fast. So they considered it almost redundant. When you say, I humbled my soul with fasting, they just say, I kept a fast, because it's almost like saying the same thing twice, the way they look at it. So afflicting your souls is fasting. Let's go to Isaiah 58. And there you see it quite clearly, Isaiah 58. And I just want to read a verse using a Tanakh, and then I'll go back to the New King James. But in Isaiah 58, verse 3, why have we fasted, they say, Isaiah 58:3, and you have not seen? And why have we afflicted our souls, and you take no notice? Okay, so now I want to go to Isaiah 58 in the Tanakh, 58 and verse 3, and let's see what he says there. When we fasted, I'm sorry, let's go to, why when we fasted did you not see? Why when we starved our bodies did you pay no heed? That's how they translate that. Afflicted our souls. When we starved our bodies, did you pay no heed? So you see obviously how they're understanding this expression. Afflicting your souls refers to fasting. And as I said, afflicting our souls is a way of putting us in a humble frame of mind and preparing us for the next great season, 8 days of instruction. And there God puts us in a perhaps better setting than we normally are in some cases, or at least even if we're in a temporary dwelling like a booth, but we're with friends and family, and we're in eating and drinking, and we're not working, you know, and so we're in a frame of mind to learn. And so, you know, one hopes that the messages are effective and also absorbed by the listeners. But let's go to Isaiah 58. Cry aloud, spare not, lift up your voice like a shofar, right? That's one of the meanings of the shofar, you know, the voice of the church. Cry aloud, spare not, lift up your voice like a trumpet. Tell my people their transgression, and the house of Jacob their sins. Yet they seek me daily, and delight to know my ways, as a nation that did righteousness, and did not forsake the ordinance of their God. They ask of me the ordinance of justice, they take delight in approaching God. So here we're talking about people who seem to be on the surface religious or observant, and yet there's issues here, very deep human problems. They seem to be very diligent and legalistic about some of the laws, maybe the first four, but maybe not so good about the last six. That was the situation in the first century when Jesus found the Jewish community there. They were very zealous about the first four commandments, were having really real problems with the last six. Why have we fasted, they say, and you have not seen? Why have we afflicted our souls and you take no notice? In fact, in the day of your fast, you find pleasure and exploit all your laborers. So people were technically fasting, but they really weren't changing their way of life. Indeed, you fast for strife and debate, and to strike with the fist of wickedness. You will not fast as you do this day to make your voice heard on high. So you're being self-righteous, and you're being arrogant, and you're being technically correct, maybe, but not in the true sense. Your righteousness is only legalistic, superficial. Notice what he says to them, whoever it is that this applies to. Is it a fast that I have chosen, a day for a man to afflict a soul? Is it to bow down his head like a bulrush and to spread out sackcloth and ashes? Would you call this a fast, an acceptable day to the Eternal? So the rituals have a role to play, but we need to be working internally on the inside, right? And what's going on inside? Is this not the fast that I have chosen? To loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, and that you break every yoke. So if you fast and then go and you're a boss and you oppress your workers, for example, if you fast and you're a civic official and you take unfair advantage of those whom you're responsible for, etc., etc., then maybe you have technically kept the day, but that's not the purpose of the day has gone by past you. Is it not to share your bread with the hungry, and that you bring to your house the poor who are cast out? When you see the naked, that you cover him and not hide yourself from your own flesh. Then your light shall break forth like morning. Your healing shall spring forth speedily, and your righteousness shall go before you. The glory of the Eternal shall be your rear guard. In the old, old archaic language, the word was rearward. If some of you are using an old King James, it's not a typo. It's not re-reward. It's not a typo. It's rearward, or your rear guard. Then you shall call, and the Eternal will answer. You shall cry, and he will say, "Here I am." If you take away the yoke from your midst, the pointing of the finger and speaking of wickedness. In other words, I would think part of this is accusing people and castigating people unfairly. If you extend your soul to the hungry and satisfy the afflicted soul, then your light shall dawn in the darkness, and your darkness shall be as the noonday. The Eternal will guide you continually and satisfy your soul in drought. Now, recently there was very heavy rain in Southern California, I believe. Well, let's keep praying for California that things work out really well this rainy season there, and they get not flooding, but very nice rainfall. Let's keep California in our prayers, Arizona, Nevada, those areas. I think there's also been bad weather in Brazil and in Poland, very dry weather. If any of you are from there and want to let me know what's going on, as far as I understand, there were drought conditions in at least part of Brazil and in Poland. Well, you know what droughts are. They're very, very serious problems. And God says that in terms of the nation of Israel, if they respond and treat each other as they should, then he will pour out a blessing on that nation. So speaking, of course, through Isaiah. The Eternal will guide you continually and satisfy your soul in drought and strengthen your bones. You shall be like a watered garden and like a spring of water whose waters do not fail. Those from among you shall build the old waste places. So if we serve God effectively, including the last six of the Ten Commandments, we can look forward, if we're converted minds, to the resurrection. And in the millennium, we'll have the opportunity to really serve humankind in a very powerful way. We'll have the opportunity to spread peace and prosperity, understanding to all of humanity. What a wonderful future we have in mind. I know some people have had the courage, the boldness, the unselfishness to volunteer for things like institutions like the Peace Corps and do that kind of work, or Habitat for Humanity, or these sorts of things. So I must metaphorically tip my hat to those people. Now, those of you who are part of God's church will be able to accomplish in the millennium far more than they did. I'm not taking away from what they did, but in the millennium, God's people will be able to accomplish even far, far more. Isaiah 58:12. Those from among you shall build the old waste places. You shall raise up the foundations of many generations, and you shall be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of streets to dwell in. I would like to continue now in terms of the theme of the day, which is, in effect, the liberation, the emancipation of humankind. I'm going to show you today how that's going to be achieved. This day pictures that very solemn moment when humankind is liberated from the most wicked of tyrants. The most wicked of tyrants. And we'll get to that. But I first want to go to Leviticus 25. Leviticus 25. The seventh year of release has just recently ended, the Shemitah, the sabbatical year. Some of you read the Pentateuch through. I salute you for that. You can still finish it up, though, before the eighth day. You have an extension, because the way it works, you can continue reading the Pentateuch through and finish it by the eighth day if you haven't finished it. So you still have, you know, a little bit of time before the bell rings on the seventh year as far as reading the Pentateuch. But there are no longer Jubilee years being kept. But in ancient times, the Jubilee year, when it was instituted, was just a wonderful institution. You know, if people had really gotten down and out, it gave them a new start on life, a new beginning for the family. And it began on the Day of Atonement in the 50th year. Leviticus 25 and verse 8. Leviticus 25 and verse 8. And you shall count seven Sabbaths of years for yourself, seven times 7 years. And the time of the seven Sabbaths of years shall be to you 49 years. Verse 9. Then you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement. You shall make the trumpet to sound throughout all your land. And you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all its inhabitants. Americans, you remember that? Sound our Liberty Bell in Philadelphia. Those of you who are outside the United States, Americans should know this passage well. It's on our Liberty Bell in Philadelphia. And you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you, and each of you shall return to his possession, and each of you shall return to his family. So it was a new beginning for the family every 50 years. So that was a very important institution, and it's connected with this Day of Atonement. Well, now, the question is, or the question that I've raised is, how is this emancipation achieved? Well, step number one, of course, God judges the earth, the world, the civilization. He punishes those who have been wicked. Jesus Christ returns to set up the kingdom of God. But then there's one vital step after that, a critical step. I want to go to Leviticus 16. Before I do, I want to get the New Testament so that you know where I'm going. The central character, the central personality on the Day of Atonement is the high priest. The high priest was the hero of the Day of Atonement. He went into the Holy of Holies once a year on the Day of Atonement, and many people feared he would not come out alive. The Talmud says that in Talmudic times, they would tie a rope around the high priest. And if he died in there, others wouldn't dare enter, but they would pull him out. Isn't that interesting? I don't know. What can I say about it? It is a Jewish tradition. And so when the high priest came out alive, wow, the excitement, because the people knew that the nation had been reconciled to God, that the ritual had gone well. The high priest had been worthy. He had done what he needed to do. The ritual had been successful. He comes out, and it was a time of great joy in the land of Judea in the time of Christ, when the high priest came out of the Holy of Holies. Excuse me. He was the hero of the day. Now, all of you know, if you're Christians, what this pointed to. It pointed to our high priest, Jesus Christ. And through him, we have access to the Holy of Holies in the heavens, the celestial Holy of Holies. We have access through Jesus Christ. I want to go to Hebrews 4. Hebrews 4 and verse 14, I believe I want. Hebrews 4 and verse 14. Seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. you know, what we understand and believe. Let's hang in there with it. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. God became man, and in the ministry of Jesus Christ, the Word of God went through human life, yet without sin. And so in that sense, he qualified to become our high priest eternally. Let us therefore, the author writes of the book of Hebrews writes, let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. So the high priest on the Day of Atonement was a type of Jesus the Christ, who is truly the intercessor, the one who makes peace between God and human beings. And he is going to return as the groom with the church as his bride. You know, the Orthodox Jews have a tradition that the wedding couple fasts before their wedding, repents of their sins and fasts before their wedding. That's an interesting concept because, in effect, you know, our fast today is preparing us for that time when we meet, when we as risen saints meet the coming Jesus Christ as the groom. He's not here yet. So as he said, we fast in mourning, looking forward to his coming, looking forward to the consummation of the marriage. You might call it the honeymoon stage, right? We're looking forward to that. All right, I want to go to Leviticus 16. What went on that day? What did the high priest do? That's what I'm getting to now. What is Jesus Christ going to do specifically to liberate human beings? I'm going to show you. And Leviticus 16 talks about it. There are rituals on the Day of Atonement the high priest did that foreshadow what Jesus Christ will do. So it's important to have an awareness of that. So let's go to Leviticus 16:8, verse 6. I'm sorry, Leviticus 16 and verse 6. Aaron shall offer the... I'll read it. Aaron shall offer the bull as a sin offering, which is for himself. So first he has to square himself before he squares the community and make atonement for himself and for his house. And of course, Jesus Christ didn't have to do that. His death was for us. He was sinless. And now verse 7. He shall take the two goats and present them before the Eternal at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. I want to make sure about the what we call the goats. Let's take a look here in verse 7. Verse 8. Yes, verse 8 is what I want. I want to make sure we see how they're labeled. Then Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats. One lot is for the Eternal. Now that goat is sacrificed, and it becomes a type of Jesus Christ who was sacrificed for our sins. So that goat is for Yahweh, for the Eternal. Adonai, the Jews say nowadays. Then Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats, one lot for the Eternal, for the Lord. And the other lot is for Azazel. The other lot is for Azazel. What is that? Well, Azazel, some people believe that it's a literary way of saying complete removal, because that goat is completely taken away. Out! You know, that goat is taken way far away. However, if you look at Azazel, if you broke it down etymologically, it looks like the goat that leaves, you know, that escapes, like, as it says here, the scapegoat. It's the scapegoat. Now, if you look at the NRSV, the New Revised Standard Version that you will study in the university, if you take a Bible course in the university, you'll get the NRSV, and they know that in later literature, Azazel was known as the prince of the demons. So this goat that's the Azazel goat, it's really a type of Satan the devil. And it is taken out of contact with the community And that is the only way, really, humankind will be able to be reconciled with God in the full sense. They need to get their mind cleared. They need to get rid of an influence that is influencing them to be hostile. It's kind of a barrier there that has to be gotten rid of. So that very powerful influence that God has allowed for the time being must be removed. Satan has to be decommissioned. Invalid. I'm trying to think of the right word. Without strength. I'm trying to think of the right word. Nullified maybe is a good word. His strength nullified. And those fallen angels who serve him, the demons, who have an influence over the world. I know many people don't want to believe in that or admit that. But really, you cannot explain what's going on in the world without that kind of influence, that people could have stooped to such barbarity in such mass numbers and in such hideous ways. The explanation is this outside influence that is there, that is insane and insanely wicked and incorrigibly wicked. And that influence must be removed. And it's a tyranny over human beings. It prevents human beings from fulfilling their potential. That's going to be removed, just as his goat is removed here. Then Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats, one lot for the eternal and the other lot for the scapegoat. Now he has to cast lots, and I think that shows you that God has to intervene for us to truly understand and discern between good and evil. You know, because the two goats look alike, but the lots tell you which one is for God and which one is Azazel. So I think that's a lesson there, that you need God's help to really discern good and evil. Sometimes we don't have enough spiritual power, enough discernment to know. And so we need God's help in those kinds of cases. Everybody all right with that? Now, just to show you that on the folk level, on the street level, people understand this verse. In Israel, if they tell you to go to hell, they'll tell you, Lech Lazazel. So they get the point of this verse. Then Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats, one lot for the eternal and the other lot for the scapegoat, Azazel. And Aaron shall bring the goat on which the Lord, eternal's lot fell and offer it as an offering. Jesus Christ died for our sins, as we understand. Of course, he was resurrected and he's alive now. Verse 10. But the goat on which the lot fell to be the scapegoat shall be presented alive before the eternal to make atonement upon it and to let it go as a scapegoat into the wilderness. And Aaron shall bring the... I want to jump further about what happens to that goat. I want to go further into the account. Yeah, let's go to verse 21. All right, so far you understand what's going on with that goat? The goat for Yahweh was sacrificed, but the goat for Azazel, it's sent out into the wilderness. Now let's read more about it. Let's go to verse 21. Aaron shall lay both his hands on the head of the live goat, both his hands on the head of the live goat, confess over it all the iniquities of the children of Israel and all their transgressions concerning all their sins, putting them on the head of the goat, and shall send it away into the wilderness by the hand of a suitable man. So maybe another priest, but not just anyone should do this. A suitable man should be some light in the community, you know, a person who's a stable, solid member of the community should do this, should take the goat away. And notice the goat, it bears the sins of the people. Satan, evidently through a serpent, and he's symbolized in the Bible as a serpent, Satan as a serpent caused Adam and Eve to rebel in a very serious way against their creator. And then it was, ladies and gentlemen, human beings who first hid themselves from God. God did not first hide himself from humankind, but rather humankind hid from God initially. If you remember the account, and humankind through the sin of Adam and Eve, you know, a choice was made to not trust God, to let us know what is right and wrong, but to kind of go our own way, which is Satan's way to a large extent. So that influence, we opened ourselves up to that influence, and it's been here now, influencing human events, human affairs. And so in that sense, it is Satan and the demons who are ultimately responsible for sin. They influence people to go the wrong way. God does not influence you to sin. Oh, no. When you are tempted, as the Bible says, you know, it is the dark side that is tempting you and causing you to sin. You know, God wants you to be righteous for your own good. Sin is self-destructive. God is perfect love. So it is Satan and his demons that bring about sin. And so, and they were the first sinners. Satan was the first sinner. He was the first liar and would-be murderer, etc. And so, therefore, they bear that responsibility. And they're removed. And that makes a very big difference then. Because then people will have a different mindset. In the millennium, people will be different. Let's put it this way. It'll be easier to be good. It'll be easier to be virtuous in the millennium. People won't have the same negativity to battle that people tend to have today. Now, admit it. All of you have it. You know, I was just thinking today about some things I did as a child. You know, it just came to my mind for whatever reason. I did some pretty crazy things. Well, they're more than crazy. They would have got me in big trouble if they'd been discovered. Yeah, fortunately for me, they were not. It's too late now for me to go back and do anything about it. Way too late. You know, but that's not something you should dwell on. You know, if God's forgiven you if you've been baptized. The blood of Jesus Christ washes your sins away. But I'm just saying, you know, all of you need to understand you've got to see me or sign. But the people who live in the millennium will have an easier time of it, you could say. You know, they'll have an easier battle to fight than we have. Of course, if we have God's spirit, that gives us the power to fight the fight and to win the fight. But anyway, let's go back to the goat. Verse 22, the goat shall bear on itself all their iniquities to an uninhabited land, and he shall release the goat in the wilderness. See, the goat isn't killed, but released. Now, these rituals point to actual prophetic events. And now that I've talked about it, let's go to the fulfillment of these events. Let's start with a little bit of background from Revelation 12. Now, there are times on the Day of Atonement when ministers go through more background on Satan and what he is like and what he does and where he came from. Today I thought I would go to the solution, what happens to him, and just briefly discuss, you know, who he is and where he came from. God did not create a devil. God did not create a devil. Satan was originally an angel of light. He sinned. He became what he became, and he convinced a third of the angels to follow him. They became fallen angels, demonic. They are now insane. You shouldn't analyze their behavior. It's insane. That's a little bit of background. Let's go to Revelation. Before I go to Revelation, I want to show you a little bit about this world and how it operates. Whether you like it or not, this is the truth. Ephesians 2. There is an influence on people that is a downward pull. We call it human nature, but it's actually external. Let's go to Genesis 1:28. Genesis 1:28. I hope some of you are out there listening live, but in any case, you'll hear this. I know many of you will listen to this whenever you can. In Genesis 1:28. Wrong. I'm going even further than that. Verse 31, the end of the 6 days of creation, or I would call it recreation of the world for Adam and Eve and their descendants. Genesis 1:31. Then God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. Tov ma'od. So the evening and the morning were the sixth day. What he created was very good. So the fact that we have such a downward pull, that's very difficult to deal with at times, that's something that's an external influence, wasn't with us initially. It came because of the rebellion of Adam and Eve, when they in effect allowed Satan to take over for a time. God allowed it, but Satan is now in effect ruling the world in that sense. Not totally. I mean, people have free will. People can't overcome. But there is that influence there. And let's go to Ephesians 2 and verse 2. I'll start in the first verse. And you he made alive, who were dead in trespasses and sins, in which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience. So there's an influence there that influences us that's there, that's out there. And it's not really innately in us. But it works on us. It's there. You can overcome it. You don't have to fear it. Just be aware. 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 4. Easy to remember. Whose minds the God of this world has blinded, who do not believe, lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them. So Satan is called the God of this world. Small g. You know, he does have a great deal of power. But as I said, God is ultimately in control. His power is limited by God. And people have the ability to be virtuous people. It takes training. It takes discipline. And for Christians to truly obey and understand, it takes God's Spirit, which is available when we repent and are baptized and make that commitment. Well, this is going to sound funny, but the Bible flipped over 2 Corinthians 11, so I'll read it. I plan to skip it, but the Bible has blown over to 2 Corinthians 11, so I'll go ahead and read it. All right? Let's not get mystical about it. But anyway, 2 Corinthians 11. There are some ministers who are false ministers. Not every minister, please. Just like policemen, you know? Policemen, every once in a while a policeman abuses his office. We love the police. We respect the police, right? Hopefully. I hope so. We sure do need the police. What would life be like without the police? I don't want to imagine it. You know what the Pirkei Avot says? The Ethics of the Fathers says, pray for the existing government. If not for fear of it, people will be eating each other alive. Well, even the New Testament says something along the same lines. But being from the yeshiva world, I often quote Pirkei Avot as well. Sorry. I'm not sorry, no. Okay, anyway, let's go to 2 Corinthians 11. If you want to see the New Testament account of that, it's Romans 13, among others. Romans 13. And also, I believe 2 Timothy talks about that, doesn't it? Or 1 Timothy, talking about the praying for those in authority. Yes, 1 Timothy 2. Okay, but I'm in 2 Corinthians 11, and I want to say that some ministers are actually false ministers. You know, there are all kinds of hucksters in the ministry. Isn't that sad? But you've been aware of that. Some of you have dealt with ministers who were very likely abusive, oppressive, and many of you have been aware of ministers who have been hucksters. Some have even finally wound up arrested, prosecuted in courts, right? Ministers. It's happened. So there are false ministers, and Paul says that here. He warns us about it. 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 13. For such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into apostles of Christ. So there are false teachers. And no wonder, he says, for Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. You know, that many times people think they're doing wonderful things, you know, when they're really being very destructive. Many people who were part of these Marxist movements, these communist movements that caused so much aggravation, they thought they were acting in the best interests of humanity, advancing humanity to this great utopia that was going to be created under socialism. But in the process, an awful lot of harm was done. I'm only picking on that. I'm not, you know, I'm singling that out because it comes to mind. You could give other examples. Verse 15. Let's go to verse 14. And no wonder, for Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. Therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers also transform themselves into ministers of righteousness, whose end will be according to their works. All right. So people who do that, they're going to be dealt with. God will deal with them. In some cases, they're dealt with in this day and time. In some cases, you know, they have their comeuppance with, you know, even in this life, but in any case, they're going to be dealt with. But those are false ministers. But Satan himself, some people think of Satan, you know, they don't realize it's Satan. They think that they're involved in some wonderful movement, some godly movement, and it really is ultimately satanic. It's sad. I want to go now to Revelation 12, and I am almost finished for now. I've got a lot more to tell you, and we'll be telling you that those things later on. But in Revelation 12 and verse 10, I'll go there, because one of Satan's characteristics is accusing, trying to get people into trouble. He's called in Hebrew HaSatan, the adversary, Satan. He's the adversary. In Greek, he's called Diablos, the slanderer. And so he likes to accuse. So I wanted to read that to you. The Jews have a tradition that on the Day of Atonement, they go to God and they say, don't listen to the accuser. Listen to your covenant. Well, we have a better argument. You know, we have the Jesus Christ interceding for us. Then I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now salvation and strength in the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come for the accuser of our brethren who accused them before our God day and night has been cast down. Well, ultimately, Satan will rebel one more time in a major way, be cast down, and then will persecute the church. But that will then be the end of his career for quite a while, for 1,000 years, as I'm going to read to you now. I wanted to go to Revelation 20. Now, here is what the high priest rituals pictured. Here is what Jesus Christ is going to do, which this day pictures, because the rituals of this day point to what I'm going to read. The Jews have a tradition about this day, as Hasatan in Hebrew is 364. Let me just make sure of that. Sin is 300. Ted is 9. And then we have Nun is 50. And then Ha, the Hey is 5. So it comes out to 364. Hasatan, the adversary, which you see in the book of Job, is 364. So what's the Jewish tradition? Well, in a solar year, there are 365 days. But Satan has power 364 days. One day he doesn't. The Day of Atonement. It's an interesting tradition. But there's a truth hidden in it. The truth that this day pictures the time when he is incapacitated. Maybe that's the word I was thinking of. When he's incapacitated. This day pictures the time when he's put away. It's such a solemn occasion. Such an awesome occasion. We fast. Because it'll be such a different world after that. And very likely, ladies and gentlemen, it would occur, since it's the 10th day of the 7th month, very likely it will occur on the Day of Atonement at some point, maybe on that very day, and that will be truly a jubilee. And the jubilee then can truly be declared. So we'll see how that all works out. At least it pictures that day, you know. God will do it when he decides to do it. But I rather suspect it will be done on a Day of Atonement sometime. But anyway, let's go to Revelation 20. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. He's that fit person, remember? It was a suitable person, not just anybody. A suitable person because he's picturing an angel. He laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan. John likes to do that. He likes to give the Hebrew and the Greek, which I did too. Diablos and Satan. He likes to do that. And that's when I have an affinity for John's writings, because he goes into Greek and Hebrew. He laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years, and cast him into the bottomless pit, and shut him up, and set a seal on him, so that he should deceive the nations no more, till the 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released a little while. But we have 1,000 years without that downward pull. 1,000 years without Satan and his demons. They're in the wilderness, as it were. They're in this bottomless pit, in the abyss, away from being able to influence people. Now, at the end of 1,000 years, they're released, but briefly. And that's the last time that they will have any kind of sway over humanity. We go to verse 10. What finally happens is in verse 10 of this chapter. After the millennium, before a period of final judgment, before that time, between the millennium and the period known as the Great White Judgment period, a Great White Throne Judgment, I should say. Great White Throne Judgment period, right? You can look at the Great White Throne. You can read about it in the same chapter. The great white throne. But that's in verse 11. I'm going to verse 10. The devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone. So he gets to be thrown in where all of the wicked people had been burned up. The beast and the false prophet who dominated the world when Jesus Christ returned, they were thrown into that pit. So now he's put into that pit. So he gets to, in effect, see the fruit of his sinfulness, all these eons that he's been sinful. The devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and false prophet, it should be were cast. There's a translation that says that. I think the, believe it or not, the Jerusalem Bible, a Catholic translation, I think says were cast or something along those lines, if you want to check it out. I think it may be in the Jerusalem Bible, which is a Catholic Bible. Anyway, he's put there where the beast and false prophet 1,000 years earlier had been burned up. And they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. So they live on in torment, at least as long as the earth is as it is today, through that white throne judgment period, evidently. I believe that ultimately we're going to have a new heaven, a new earth, and when that happens, I don't believe they will even exist anymore. That's my belief. But they will be in torment for a while, you know, during that white throne judgment period, but unable to influence anybody, but in torment. And then later, I believe they'll be out of existence. But those of us who are righteous will live forever as spirit. And we come now to the conclusion then of the matter. So this Day of Atonement is a critical step in the conclusion of the matter, because it does picture God's ultimate triumph over Satan, complete triumph over Satan. He always is in control, and whatever Satan does, God has allowed it. But ultimately, God gets rid of that influence entirely. It's gone forever. And then we have this atonement, this reconciliation, and this union of God and human beings on the spirit plane, this great family of God. And let's read about it briefly in Revelation 21, because that's what this Day of Atonement points to. So I want to go to verse 3 of Revelation 21, to the conclusion that this day points to. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. Right now, some of you may have hunger pangs. Hang in there. But remember that you're picturing a time when you won't need to worry about eating. You'll picture a time when you're spirit and you won't have to be fed. Wow. Don't worry. You'll enjoy life as a spirit being far more than whatever your best meal was. You know, the Bible pictures spirit life as a banquet, as a wedding banquet. So think of the fact what you did. Think of what you did if you had a honeymoon. You had a banquet, then you went off with your spouse, you know, and consummated your marriage. Think of that as a type of the joys you'll experience in God's kingdom. Verse 5. Then he who sat on the throne said, behold, I make all things new. And he said to me, write, for these words are true and faithful. So this holy day pictures, foreshadows, reminds us of a future, a wonderful future, a new beginning for humanity. I think I did go a little longer than I normally do, but I warned you that I would, that I might. This is a Bible study forum, and I warned you I might go a little longer. I'd like to make a few announcements. I'd like us to pray for Margaret Campbell. Her son, Dave, has a ministry, and her husband is Alexander. They've been here for the festival in the past of Tabernacles on the Eighth Day. But anyway, they live in Canada and British Columbia. And Margaret has difficulties breathing, so please keep her in your prayers so that she'll really have an enjoyable festival season from here on out. Please keep the Campbell family in your prayers, Alexander, Margaret, and also David Campbell, who has a ministry. Also, I'd like to announce that there will be services this Sabbath. I know that a lot of you are on the road, you're traveling, but we're going to have a live service here, and then of course it'll be recorded. You can see it whenever you're able to see it. But it'll be 3 p.m. Eastern time for the. It won't be. Oh, I'm sorry. We're going to change it for this one Sabbath. For this one Sabbath, I have to announce specially. So I hope a lot of you are hearing this. If you want to hear it live, it'll be 2 p.m. Eastern time this Sabbath. Okay. I will repeat again. For this one Sabbath during the year, the Sabbath between Atonement and the Festival of Tabernacles, we are going to have a 2 p.m. service live. So if you want to be there live, if you're out in Southern California, have to be there at 11, I guess. 11 a.m. Or in Wisconsin, 1 a.m. I'm sorry, 1 p.m. 1 a.m. if you want to hear a recording of it later. You know, 1 a.m. the next morning. But 1 p.m., okay? So 2 p.m. this Sabbath. And now, on Sunday evening, we're going to have a welcome service. Welcome to the Festival of Tabernacles in Washington, D.C. Now, the Pope won't be there by then. Sorry about that, I guess. I won't be sorry, but maybe some of you will. But he won't be there, but we'll be there. And it'll be in Sunday evening service. It'll be at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. So some of you may want to tune in wherever you are. Some of you may want to show up. That's great. The more the merrier. But if you can't be there and want to tune in live, it's 8 p.m. Sunday. The next day is a holy day, and I believe services are at the usual 3 p.m. time. Monday, right? On the holy day, there'll be 3 p.m. Now, some of you may want to follow us one way or the other during the festival season. And if you want to know when our services are, it will be today, right? Mm-hmm. Today it will be available to you. Today it will be available to you on the website. Okay. Now, we won't have Q&A on the holy days, but perhaps during the Festival of Tabernacles, questions will come up regarding what I'm talking about. And so I certainly would be happy to clarify whatever points come up. And I would also like to say this about the Festival of Tabernacles. On Sunday, the seventh day of that festival, the great day, Hoshana Rabbah, as it's called by the Jews, the seventh day of the Festival of Tabernacles, I'll be speaking not only to the people in D.C. and whoever normally listens to me, but I'll be speaking to a much larger audience, those who keep the feast in Iowa and those who are connected with the Congregational Fellowship of God through the year. So that'll be a special time when you'll have to hook into thinkgod.org to get the service, thinkgod.org. But we'll give you information on the website on that. But I'm just telling you in advance, Sunday morning, it'll be 10:30 Eastern Time. We'll have a service that you'll need to connect into using the website thinkgod.org. Are we all right? No confusion yet? Okay. I have a very serious thing I wanted to say for the end. A family named McDonald, I believe in the Chicago area, had twins born that were conjoined, I think at the head, but I think it's something that can be operable. It is operable. So the operation can take place. That's just a wonderful thing about 2015, what the technology allows. I believe that an operation can take place and the two can be separated and can therefore both survive. However, we want to pray about that situation, certainly, and for that family. Their name is McDonald. I don't know the first and last names of the couple, but please pray for the twins and please pray for the McDonald family that are going through that serious trial at this time. Please pray for the McDonald family. Well, I know a lot of you may already be, after this Sabbath, or this holy day rather, preparing for your trips or at least, you know, making your plans at least mentally or on paper before you maybe begin actually physically doing it. So certainly there's a lot we're looking forward to, spiritually speaking, in terms of the coming festival season. So we hope and pray that it will be the best ever for all of you. All the best to you and yours.